Hello and welcome to A Noise from the Deep, the Green Leaf Music Podcast. My name is Michael Bates and...
I'm Dave Douglas, and we'll be speaking with saxophonist and composer Greg Osby, a musician who hopefully needs no introduction. Check out the Greenleaf Music website for more information.
And you can rate and review us at iTunes. It helps people find out what we're doing and where we're at.
And a new thing, you know, if you leave a particularly witty review of our show, we will read it on the show and then send you free Greenleaf stuff. How about that? So thanks for listening, and hope you enjoy the podcast.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
The technology prevails. How about this? Nice. Hey,
so we started the show with the track Channel 3 from with your trio with Matt and Jeff Watts.
Right.
And I wanted to start this interview with just sort of asking you about the challenges of composing and playing trio and finding new ways to orchestrate the music. And that's, I think that tune is a really great example in that you guys are singing on it.
Exactly. Well, I mean, my idea of the trio for myself stemmed from the fact that most trios sound like a quartet with the piano muted. And it sound like, you know, a bit of, you know, displacement or you know, compensation for, you know, a missing element, you know, either a bad piano or possibly a bad pianist. So I wanted to write music that was actually composed, you know, for the individuals at hand, as well as some music that sounded full. And, you know, it definitely, you know, absolutely sounded like it was, you know, intended to be such and not, you know, just the byproduct of muting or, you know, making some alteration. And, you know, it's a bit difficult to pull off, you know, because, you know, there are, you know, two voices going on at all times, and there's a great deal of coordination involved in that particular piece. Some of the other pieces, you know, are solely instrumental. But it worked out really well. I didn't use too much modeling of, you know, any, you know, pre-existing trio offerings. I tried not to because, you know, there are some, you know, and the weight of what they represent was too great. So I just, you know, tried to do something, you know, that fashioned, you know, what I thought a contemporary trio should sound like. It came off really well.
Was it difficult to convince the guys to sing?
No, it wasn't. It was just difficult to get people to stop laughing in the studio because, yeah. I mean, everybody got into laughing fits and giggling, and it was, you know, infectious. And it just, so that was the challenge.
So they wanted to sing. They didn't have a
They wanted to sing. Them. They were up for it, and it was, you know, unorthodox at that point, and you know, it worked out really well. I mean, you know, there are some rough spots, and you know, it goes off kilter, you know, in some areas, but that's to be expected, and that also like really enhances the, you know, the humanity, you know, element that's sorely missing from a lot of things to me. I like the fact that, you know, that it's imperfect, and you know, there are derivations, you know, from, you know, just a straight line. Now I like that.
I want to ask you a question. This is Dave speaking. You know, we were at Berkeley at the same time in the early 80s. And
right.
A lot of the people who were in school with us then are now, you know, like, for example, we were just hearing Jeff Watts on your record. And
so many people were there at the time and are here in New York now, but something that developed in your playing in the intervening years, it's always kind of amazed me how you come up with unique melodic language, mm-hmm. you know, intervals and rhythmic approaches to melody. I don't know if you remember a night in the early 90s at Visiones when I came and you invited me to sit in with your band. Mm-hmm. And I got my ass thoroughly kicked by you and Steve Coleman on Just One of Those Things.
I remember that, but I don't remember it, you know, in the same light that you do. There was no ass kicking. It was just, you know, differences in approach and you know, ideologies and
okay, you're and very expression. Kind. Yeah, you're very kind and generous. But I guess I wanted to ask you, you know, what can you describe your approach on how you came up with all of that unique language?
Well, basically speaking, a lot of it stems from being the product of, you know, a self-taught education primarily. I mean, I taught myself, and I learned to play the saxophone in a very unorthodox manner, meaning that by the time I got to a college level, you know, there were a lot of grounding elements and fundamentals that I had no idea. There were keys on the saxophone that I didn't know what they meant, what they represented.
Really?
Yeah, and actually, I played everything the most difficult way possible, you know, because I played it with the most difficult fingering because I had no mentoring, I had no teacher. Hmm. I'm from the inner city of St. Louis, and we had no high school band program, and I played in a lot of funk and rhythm and blues bands, you know, with older guys who were also ear players. And interestingly enough, you know, all of the songs we played, you know, it was a cover band, and we played everything in probably the most difficult key imaginable because we learned all of our music off of this turntable, which was, you know, an old belt drive turntable that played either half step too fast or half step too slow,
right,
depending on the humidity or the weather. So we played everything in C, you know, in the key of, you know, C sharp or B. So I really became really proficient and fluent in all of the multi-flatted and sharp keys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I didn't know any better.
Right, right.
And I played it with the most difficult fingering possible when there was, you know, always an easier route.
So when you figured out that those tunes were actually in B flat or C, were you really pissed off?
No, I wasn't. I mean, actually, you know, later on it became advantageous, you know,
right,
especially when I started to play with a lot of rock bands and all the tunes were in A and B and D and you know, and E, you know, stuff like that. So that helped too. So I became, you know, very, very proficient technically. And also, I was writing music at that time, too, but I had no idea of, you know, the staples of notation. So I had note heads going in the wrong direction, stems going. It was all twisted and everything, but it made sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also had a great affinity, you know, towards logic and math.
Yeah,
and symmetry and geometry and things like that. Because my first endeavor was to be an architect, so I guess people can still hear that in my music.
Was there some system that came about based on math, like around MBASE or around, you know, around that time when you were developing those new kinds of lines?
Absolutely. You know, upon, you know, my arrival to New York and meeting Steve, you know, we had these lengthy marathon discussions about direction and approach and concept, as opposed to emulation and just, you know, call and response or just recalling, you know, prescribed internalized content, you know, just remembering licks more or less.
Uh-huh.
And we, you know, we did an inventory, a personal inventory, and, you know, and just kind of made a note of the people who really had identifiable characteristics in their playing, either sonic ones or rhythmic ones, or, you know, they had a system of composition, you know, the Henry Threadgills, the Muhar Richard Abrams, you know, the people who really had something that was super identifiable. And we sought out, you know, to dissect and analyze that and find out what particulars made them stand out. and to figure out something of our own, things that we, you know, I guess individually we worked on privately, but really didn't employ publicly. And the reason I didn't employ a lot of stuff publicly because I really didn't have it together technically. Because a lot of the things that I was trying to do, they don't really set well easily on the saxophone. It's more of like a keyboard logic. It's more, I would say it's more polyphonic than monophonic. And since, you know, I can only play one note at a time,
right,
I had to figure out a way to condense or compress this information. And hence, you know, you get a lot of skips and leaps, you know, when you're trying to deal with a two-handed logic. So that's kind of the basis for what I'm dealing with. It's kind of a frustrated pianistic approach. So,
and we're talking about back in the day. What year are we?
We're talking about around 1982, 83, 84. Okay. That was like the initiates of, you know, what became the M-Bass Collective, because, you know, we found other people who were down to rehearse a lot and to practice on, you know, loops of, you know, four, mm-hmm. eight bars ad infinitum, you know, just to get it right. You know, alternative compound meters and you know, modified harmonic means, you know, you know, the addition of certain things and the deletion of other things, characteristics that were normal to people.
Could you give an example of sort of some of the melodic content, an idea in terms of harmonically what you guys were thinking about?
Well, you know, to be honest, I mean, I can't really say in detail what Steve was doing, because I purposely avoided a lot of it theoretically, because, you know, we were good friends and we hung out all day long and all night long. And so and naturally, a lot of that was going to rub off, you know, just by osmosis. So I didn't really want to get into it theoretically, because then we would mirror each other to the point that was even worse than what people blamed us for anyway.
Right.
You know, and cause he's very strong and has a very solid thing. So, I just wanted to have my thing. My thing kind of resolved itself to being what I now call, the acronym is SMO, which is a shifting melodic order, which meant that I would take fragments of my melodicism and I would re-registrate them into other areas. And so it's kind of like a monophonic stride, if you will.
Yeah,
you know, and so you get a lot of progressions, you know, and it kind of almost looks like a seismograph or something. You
in
know,
a
like
weird way, it's sort of thinking vertically in a linear sense, or
thinking
linearly but using vertical structures.
Absolutely, and you know, again, you know, the technical demands are such that it took me a long time to get it together. I was on the threshold of abandoning it a lot of times. Until I, you know, listened back to recordings where it hooked up in certain areas. So then I had to, you know, through the process of elimination, eliminate some things that just wouldn't come together on the instrument.
So you're talking about like parts of a line being displaced either by the octave or by various intervals?
Right. Or, I would set up a rhythmic and intervallic precedence for certain chunks. So I would like, you know, have like equidistant, you know, rhythmic or melodic variables that I would set up even before I would step to the microphone. I said, I'm going to play this, and then I'm going to take this part of the melodic line, and I'm going to either re-registrate it intervallically, or I'm going to, you know, make these rhythmic modifications. And I would use what I would call the, different proportions. I would say, well, for these next two choruses, for instance, I might use an excessive amount of this interval, maybe minor thirds and minor seconds, combined, you know, with an inordinate amount of triplets or, you know, these types of tuplets. So that would, like, inform, you know, the melodicism that was to follow, because now I've already set, like, a palette for myself, you know, some parameters.
Right.
So be free for all, whatever I want to do. It's within these rules that I set up for myself. And this applied equally over standards and original compositions. Hence, after a while, you start to, you know, to establish an identity on everything, because you're now, you know, you have a logic going, and you know, you have like a frame that you set for yourself.
This comes a bit later, but do you think that tune Interruption is a good example of that language in use?
Well, Interruption, that actually stems from another departure in terms of composition. See, that particular CD, which is entitled Inner Circle, was produced after almost a year straight of touring. I mean, just like almost nonstop. And, you know, with that band, that song represents, you know, it's like a, I guess, a melodic depiction, or, you know, harmonic, or, you know, progressive depiction of, you know, my birth date and my birth time, the exact time I was born, and the relationship of the sun and the distance of the sun to the earth and the earth to the moon at that time. So I took those distances, and then I made markers for those distances, and between each marker represented, like, you know, a note or a note in a chromatic scale. So I came up with scales and vertical structures and chords and stuff based upon those distances. And then I spelled out my name, and I used those letters in the name and as they related, you know, to some of those distances and some of the notes that those distances represented also. So I came up, so basically, you know, people, they say, well, I'm trying to play myself, but I'm trying to be more organic. And I figured I couldn't be more organic than that. I'm playing my name and, you know, a system derived on the exact moment that I was born, which is like 12 midnight, you know, 1960, you know, August 3rd.
You and I met at the Banff Center of the Arts, and one of the things that I, you know, got to see was just how open you were to all the students. You know, these epic hangs that went to all hours of the night, where, you know, people would sort of congregate in a hut, and you would just talk about music and all, and it was just kind of an amazing thing. And one of the things that I learned from you was the concept of the call. And so you had brought out a bunch of music that use these calls that I, from what I understand, that, you know, could appear at any time in any tune, in any set, anywhere.
Right.
And you could use them. Could you talk about the concept of the call and how it applies to your music?
There were melodic cues that could happen at any time, in any song, at any tempo. And, you know, I would play these in the middle of a ballad and they would just launch us into another tune. Or I would play sections of other tunes that the bands had to memorize. You know, I don't really like music on the bandstand too much unless it's super complex. Mm-hmm. But they had to memorize all the material, so they would hear me play the B section of another tune in the middle of the current tune. So that means that we would automatically just directly, segue into that or jettison into it, depending on, you know, the instance. And it threw the audiences off. And it was also, you know, very great theater, because it was a very dramatic effect to see a band launch into a whole new vibe, you know, with nothing said, no con off, you know. There was also a time when I had some hand signals, almost like a catcher-pitcher relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would throw up fingers and, like, throw up letters that almost looked like, you know, the deaf alphabet. And I would, like, you know, throw those, to the drummer, and then he would start a new groove. Oh, and the other thing that was very essential to this was that a lot of the tunes, they had very specific drum chants and bass notation. So that means that if we're in the middle of a song and all of a sudden the band hears the bass player playing the line that's exclusive to another song, that means that we're going to that song. And that, you know, that was inspired, you know, from way back, you know, when I was on the road with Dizzy Gillespie, and I talked to him about the fact that I felt that, you know, Night in Tunisia was probably one of the only tunes, you know, in the jazz canon that had, you know, like a very specific bass line.
Mm.
As soon as you hear that bass line, you can go into that tune at that tempo without even counting it off. This was, again, spawned, you know, by the talks that I used to have with Steve in the early days of the M-Bass Collective, you know, where we were studying West African communicative drum chants, where they would have these drum chants that represented real life experiences, or, you know, it was almost like the master drummer was the center of the village or whatever. So he would play drum beats that meant, you know, Fufu is, you know, just had a new baby, or so and so, you know, just came in from a successful hunt. We're going to have a feast today, or the enemy is coming, or bad weather is coming, or whatever. And all these chants, you know, they meant something. So when these people found their way to the new world, you know, and we all know how they got there, they, you know, they retained a lot of these principles. And so now we have chants and you know, claves and all kind of stuff that stem from those things. And I think that's why a lot of music fails, because it sounds like other music so much. It's because composers don't give enough, give enough time to, you know, to identifying characteristics, you know, that are built into the music.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hey, to switch topics just for a second, you've had an important role as a mentor, you know, mentorship and hiring young musicians. And I'm just wondering if you have any particular thoughts about where you hear new musicians. Do they come to you? Do you, like, have places that you go to check them out? Or,
you know, I'm a big fan of musicians making music and thinking and talking about music. As you can probably tell, I'm super chatty, and I love the discussion. Mm. So I love the idea of teaching. I love the idea of exchange and extracting, because anybody that I listen to, you know, for whatever they're about or whatever their purposes are, I'm in it, you know, to see if there's something that I can extract and hopefully incorporate into my music and thus fortifying it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's the whole point. And I hit Smalls at least once or twice a week. That's my thing. And musicians come to me regularly, you know, through master classes, residencies, you know, teaching. I just finished, you know, a 4-year stint at Berkeley. And it's really rewarding, because I love, you know, to hear proficient young people who obviously have done the work.
Well, with that in mind, we are going to finish this interview with a tune from your CD, Nine Levels, called Optimism.
All right.
Which is comprised of a bunch of those musicians of which you speak. Amir Atwal, right. Adam Bierbaum, Nir Felder, Sarah Serpa, right?
Exactly.
So this is a great tune. And Joseph Lepore is also playing bass, right?
Yeah. Right.
Great.
All right.
So Greg, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. And it's always a pleasure to talk.
Exactly. Thanks, guys.
Well, I feel like we've just got started. We're just scratching the surface. So at some point, maybe we'll do a volume two and
that would be good.
More.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
That was our interview with Greg Osby.
Great musical mind, amazing saxophone player, great guy.
Big inspiration to me.
Yeah,
for
me
sure.
Too.
And for the record, you know, he did kick my ass then in the early 90s.
So I'd be interested in hearing about some sort of Dave Douglas compositional practice idea.
Oh, wow. Well, I'd be interested in hearing some Michael Bates compositional practice idea.
Yeah, but I get it all from you.
Oh, please. Oh, oh shucks. Gosh. Well, thank you for asking. I continue to write, and I continue to try to not write what I wrote before, you know, and find new ways to mm-hmm. say what I have to say. And one of the things that's been really interesting for me recently, and it's not that it's something new, maybe I'm using it in a slightly different way, but it's in taking the things that I write and looking at them from different perspectives. So for example, you know, if I'm writing a melody, I would immediately try to read it backwards and see what it sounds like, you know, reversing all the intervals and mm-hmm. going in the opposite direction. And I just find, and I know there are a lot of composers that work this way, but I find that it leads my ear in some really interesting different directions, both melodically and rhythmically.
Sure.
Like where you begin a phrase and how, you know, the natural contour of a melody might sprout a whole unimagined context.
One of the things that we've talked about often is sort of taking material and generating more material, and that's definitely a great way of doing it.
Right. And it's kind of that idea of that I heard Bob Brookmeyer say to a composer, you know, you only get so many good ideas per day. And then he added parenthetically, in your case, probably not too many at all. But that snarkiness aside, I think what he was trying to say was, you know, you get a good idea, don't pack a bunch of other stuff around it.
You know,
you milk, get everything you can out of it. And so by, you know, turning it upside down, putting it in different keys, different rhythms. But especially recently for me, I've been sort of fascinated by this retrograde, by right. playing things backwards and generating new material that way. You know, we never do like liner notes type credits for the podcast. The producer of A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast.
It's because we don't want anyone to know.
Okay, so I'm Dave Douglas.
I'm Michael Bates.
And this is the end of another episode. And please join us at iTunes at greenleafmusic.com. Let us know what you think. podcast@greenleafmusic.com. Lots more music coming your way. Thank you. Have a great week or month or year or life.
And all of the above.
Yeah.
See ya.